Hey guys, welcome to Masters of the Game. Today's guest is Emma Varsi. She's the creative director of Elevate Studio, a lifestyle brand specializing in interior design, styling, and property maintenance. She's been in the game going on 8 years. Emma, welcome to Masters of the Game.
Thanks so much for having me, Branko.
No worries. Welcome aboard. It's fantastic to have you. I've been meaning to do this with you for a little while, as you know, and I'm glad you are here today. So welcome to the studio. So when was that fuse actually lit? When did you get a sense of interest, sense of passion for design, styling? How did that all come about?
I think it was always there. It was just bubbling under the surface, you know. And we actually, it's funny because we styled our house to sell it. And I did the styling myself.
So this is the first home.
The first home we bought. We outgrew it so quick because it was a two bedroom, you know. And Andre was little, but he was growing really fast. And basically, I styled the house to sell it, and you know, did it all ourselves because at the time, it's so funny because we had a really great foundation already, but you know, you want to make those little tweaks to make it perfect. Mm. And I went out and bought the stuff and whatever. And the real estate agent that we used to sell it, because I didn't want it, I was in the game, but I didn't want to sell it myself, you know. We got Alex Sherwin from Point Cook Real Estate at the time, now established. He sold us the house, so we went with him and he sold
G'day
it for
Alex,
us.
If you're listening.
Yeah. Through him I really got my first crack, you know, at staging. So he saw what we did with our place and he really loved it. And back then, especially in the outer west, like there wasn't really an established property styling business. And I'd come from a space where, you know, Shawnee had a property stylist that, you know, she's had for many years and had the relationship with there in the inner northwest. So it was very much happening and had been established for a long time there. But in the outer west, styling wasn't really a thing. It wasn't done at that time. And I saw a gap and an opportunity in the market to take my learning and marry real estate, which I was, again, super passionate about and loved, with this study that I've done in interiors.
So where did that come about? Where did you do the study? Was that at what sort of course is it? Where does one go to do this?
Yep. So I did mine through RMIT. So there's so many that you can do now. You can do, basically I don't think you need to have a degree to do it. I think a lot of the learning and the knowledge that I've got can't be taught. But I did mine properly. But I also think I would definitely hire people today as if they showed that innate ability, you know, because most of it's taught on the job, honestly. That's how I feel.
Yeah. I find the same in real estate.
Yeah. You can't teach some things. You've either got it or you don't, I think. And you can teach the theory, but in practice it's really different.
You need a good teacher. You've got to have a good teacher. It doesn't matter what you have. If you don't have a good teacher, good mentor, good grounding, great environment, great company culture, if you don't have it, man, the road to success in any field, in any company, it's a long one. And your time can just be condensed so much by having a great teacher.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I did a bit of study at design school as well, you know, Jenna.
Sold some property for Josh
for them,
and Jenna.
Yeah,
A couple of their places.
So I did a bit with her too, and that was probably more – I'd probably prefer somebody almost if I'm hiring, depending on the skill set that you're hiring for. But that courses like that where I think that's a diploma in design and decoration as opposed to, you know, a degree.
Yeah.
But that's more hands-on, more practical. So I'd almost prefer someone who's completed that study.
Something like Jenna's course.
Yeah.
I think she's still doing it too.
Yeah, so. They do. Yeah.
And again, hello to Jenna if you're listening. And Joshy. But that is more of a practical hands-on type of course as opposed to more of a theoretical course. And that's kind of like what I was alluding to with the real estate side of things as well, is you can teach someone theoretically contracts and all the rest of it, but until you're actually filling them out,
and
you're making some
it.
Mistakes and then you, oh, okay, I get that now, why that's the case. And
it all clicks into place,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Because I think it's the repetition that you're learning rather than theory. Theory is one thing, but once you start applying it, that's when you really start to learn anything. So,
yeah, exactly.
Which is really interesting. So rather than work for, for somebody else, mm-hmm. you've thought, hey, I'm going to work for myself, whether mm-hmm. I succeed or otherwise, mm-hmm. Again, to use that same terminology, you know, boots and all.
Yep.
Go in, put the chips on the table, in the middle mm-hmm. of the table, let's see what comes of it. And if I fall on my sword, I fall on my sword.
Yeah.
But I'm going to die trying kind That's of thing. It. So, I mean, but you sound like you had your stuff together.
Oh, yeah. I mean, by that stage, you know, I'd just taken, you know, all of the measly savings that, like, I'd had, you know, and put it all in to buy the first house worth of stock, you know. And yeah. those early days, you look back now and you're like, oh, my God, what was I doing, you know, because you're kind of learning on the fly. But you develop very quickly. And then, like, we're not, you know, financially backed or anything like that. So we, you know, had to take out loans and, you know, do it all like that.
It's all your own money, all self-financed, all your
own money. I mean, yeah, like all the bank's money. Yeah. So it was initially, you know, our first few houses were self-financed, Nick and myself. And, you know, he very bravely let me have some of our savings to fund this business. And, yeah, I mean, it was rough those early days, you know. And then we had, you know, the opportunity to, then you get some more money and you sell your house and you make some money there and we refinance here and, you know, you do all the things that you have to succeed. But it was all in, like we, yeah.
I was just going to ask, do you think you, during this period, mm-hmm. sorry to cut you off, during this period, do you think you learned a shitload of information because you didn't have a lot to work with?
Yeah.
And you had to sort
I had
of,
to do it all myself because yeah. we had no money.
Yeah.
So it's not like – yeah. So it's not like you –
you know what I mean? When you're scrapping,
yeah.
you got to work it all out.
Yeah.
And when you're working it all out, like
that's
I said before
– It's the best because you
– That's when you're learning the most.
You're not only learning the most, you're also learning every element of your business from the very beginning, you know. So you know when it does scale up and when it does get bigger and you can afford to put people on, you can afford to outsource things, you know exactly what works and what doesn't because you've lived it. Yeah. And where your personal gaps are, you know, what my strengths are, what they're not, you know. I think it was the best possible way for me personally to learn was to be, yeah, thrown in and, you know, sink or swim and you better do it, you know. And at the time, like when I made that proper decision to like cut off full time, you know, and cut back my hours, like my health was shit. I was in adrenal fatigue. Like I was a mess, you know, shell of a human.
What's adrenal fatigue?
So basically your adrenal levels just aren't operating where they need to be. It's just
– they're sort of self-diagnosed or medically diagnosed?
No, medically, medically diagnosed at the time. It's been a long time. But, I had to make a change, you know. I think I was just beyond exhausted.
Is it essentially burnout?
Essentially, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, essentially. Yeah, it's your body telling you that
– have a break.
You're done, man. You're done. Mm. Yeah, have a break, have a rest.
Okay.
So I just wasn't – at that point in my life where I wanted to be. And it was kind of like you're fighting the machine a little bit, you know. And I had to make that decision and that shift. And then I did. And I had this opportunity come through with Alex and then we grew it, you know, from there.
Isn't it funny how life, like we spoke about before, you know, when things happen organically and
yeah.
life throws an opportunity your way.
You need to follow it.
It starts small, but, yeah, that's how I feel with this, with what I'm doing here. I really enjoy what I'm doing here with this podcast and it just feels right and it's happened mm-hmm. organically and I feel the same way like you. So,
Yeah, I think I really believe – I'm a bit woo-woo like that. Like I think the universe does have this plan for you and, you know, I talk about it all the time where it can be hard or it can be easy, you know, and you've got to take those cues when they come to you and just listen. And I do a lot of meditation and stuff nowadays. I'm trying to – you know, it's all that self-betterment, self-help kind of stuff, you know, that I'm learning as I'm trying to become a better leader and so on. But now it's like you need to take that time and that space and I'll have those moments where, you know, I'll sit there in my silence in the quiet and try and listen instead of just always be like aggressive in my approach. Yeah. Sometimes you actually need to be passive. You need to take that moment because then the answers come to you.
How long have you been meditating for?
Very first introduction I had was like, you know, your basic like body scan stuff. And that was one of our good friends is a psychologist and, you know, she gave me this kid's one to try and I was like, oh, this is kind of cool. that was probably, God, like 6 years ago, you know. And then since then it's just kind of evolved and now I try to make it
a minute, two, five, ten?
I try and do like a 10 minute.
10 minute, yeah.
Yeah, as often as I can. I really want to make a conscious effort to do it more often, because I think the best decisions that I've had have often come to me in that kind of, you know, meditative, I don't even know how to say it, state. Because you've got that time to actually stop and think. And I think when you're a business owner, particularly when you've come up the way that I have, where it's been like go, 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 and there's not a whole heap of guidance and you're doing it all from scratch and you don't have necessarily that structure or support from a business sense.
There's not that manual to refer to, is
there? Yeah, you've got to make it all up as you go, you know. So sometimes I've just found, yeah, that stillness has been really good. Like it's allowed me to think at a higher level, I think, and guide me to, the right path.
Time for reflection. You mentioned it before and we're kind of going down that path now anyway. So let's talk about some strengths and weaknesses of you personally. Mm-hmm. So let's go down the strengths path. We're talking about that. We're in that vogue now. So what sort of things that do you feel as though you've worked on over the years where you've developed them into a strength that maybe were a weakness before?
Mm-hmm.
And what things do you think you have as innate strengths, things that naturally Emma has as a strength over the next person?
So I think natural strengths are definitely like intuition, that gut feel, you know, and I've had to hone that in over the years because early days I didn't have that right at all. Or, you know, you'd have an inkling but you wouldn't follow it, you know, whereas now I follow those things really strongly. And creativity is a big one. I've always been – yeah, creative, but also ambitious with my creativity. Like,
how do you define creativity?
I think it's just a willingness to think outside the box. That's creative to me, you know, because I think no matter what industry you're in, you can be a creative, you know, you can be a creative accountant, for example, you know, or you can be a creative lawyer, you can be a creative. Probably if you're a doctor, don't be that creative. But, you know, you get my point. In a lot of industries, you can do things the way that they have to be done or they should be done, or you can do things in a way that thinks outside the box.
Less conventional path.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Obviously, in my industry, it's very obvious, you know, creativity is what we do, you know. We're bringing that creative spark to people's lives and interiors and so on. But I also think when I put my business hat on, it's that willingness to think outside of the box and the norms and like the conventions of what your industry is. That's creative, you know. I think it's that willingness at its core to not necessarily just think like a worker bee and to think like, you know, have that
like
leadership,
a business owner. Yeah.
Leadership mindset, think outside the box. That's really creativity to me.
So just on that, what I asked you before, were there any weaknesses that you think you've had previously that you've either worked into strengths or that are absolute 100% strength now?
Yep. So I have – like there's so many weaknesses that I have to outsource because I can't – you know, I wouldn't be successful or be where I am today if I didn't do that. But definitely I think what I've turned into strengths would be my – decision making. That was like a big like weakness for me.
How,
I think
how so?
Just like the fluffing around and like I didn't have like that clear direction, and I had to learn when you've got your own business, you have to learn how to make, you know, decisions. And sometimes it's like you want to make that split second decision and it be, you know, yes, I know this and this is the direction we're going in. And sometimes I think for a really long time I made decisions that weren't in line with my best interest. It's like that self-sabotage thing, you know. For a long time it was kind of like I was doing all this stuff and it's like I'm not worthy, I'm not good enough, and you know, I had like this false confidence. It's like outwardly, yeah, super confident, like she's outgoing and she's bubbly and she's this and that, whatever, but like internally it's like, oh, I'm not good enough, you know, I can't do that. Whereas I've had to learn to put that aside and turn that into a positive, you know, and a strength. And I think now I take that instinct and help my decision-making through my strengths, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas before, yeah.
No. And it sounds like what you just said before about the meditating sounds like that's been something that you've added to your arsenal that's helped you maybe think a bit clearer.
Yeah.
And it's given you – it's almost like what would you call it, like free air,
yeah.
free space,
space
where it gives you between the time where the decisions are asked to be made
yep.
and the decision actually gets made,
mm.
maybe sounding a bit more confident to have a greater gap there to give yep. you more time to not make the quickest decision. Which sometimes is the right decision.
Sometimes
in
it is. I think it's
the gut sometimes speaks.
Yeah.
But it's merely having the airspace to say, okay.
It's pushing back, and if you're not ready to make the decision, because I think, again, it comes back to like, you know, a woman in business, it's like you want to take every opportunity and yes, 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 and, you know, it's that scarcity mindset a little bit where you don't want to say no, you don't want to miss out on opportunity. Yep. Whereas now, you know, that decision-making process for me is very much, okay, we don't make decisions straight away. We take a second. It can be a brief second, you know. You can go outside and just say, "Just I need a minute. Just give me a minute. I'm just going to go for a quick walk yep. or I've got a phone call to make." Or you can do it in a way, you know, that works for you. But taking that space to just kind of stop and think and breathe and just think really clearly about, even in that split second decision making, have that breath. Is it the right thing for me? You know, think about the pros and the cons and follow your gut, you know.
So do you reckon you've mastered any of those things?
I think I have.
Or you're on the way to mastering some of those things?
I think I have, but there's always more to learn, you know. So I've mastered it in the sense where now I know how to make it work for me, but I'm still, you know, I think it's a work in progress.
Like
it's
we
funny
because, right?
you know, your podcast is called Masters of the Game, right? But I feel like you're never really a master. You know, it's like that constant evolution. And if I think once you think you're a master at everything, like you're done. There's going to be someone else coming up under who's, you know.
That's kind of my belief in this, and sort of the catch cry is people striving to achieve mastery in their field or on the path to mastery.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the people I've interviewed on here are towards the end of their working career in their 50s and 60s. They have absolutely mastered their craft because of longevity and simply time in the game.
Yep.
Whereas there's people like you, you haven't had the longevity, but I can see the trajectory that you're clearly on.
Mm.
You're building a burgeoning business really quickly and scaling it really quickly, that I can see the path that you're on, and hence why I'm curious to pick a brain like yours.
Yeah.
For someone that's, what are you, 31 years of age. Never ask a lady her age, right? But I have to hear. but it's really to make the point that you're in the very early stages of your working life and career and motherhood and everything, life in general, right?
Yes.
But at the same time, like you said, you haven't mastered your craft. You're on the way to mastering, but I can clearly see that you are absolutely on that trajectory.
It's mastering the elements as they come to you and knowing that it's never like finite, like it's not the end, you know, there's always more. And even those people who are, you know, 50 years into a career, like they're still learning and growing. And I think what sets people apart who are on that trajectory are those people who have the willingness and the understanding that they're not at that master level. They never think they are, you know.
So it's like writers, people that are fantastic writers, and they've written bestseller after bestseller on the New York bestseller list, and it's that they deem it that process of iteration. You know, you write 10,000 words and you need to condense that 10,000 into three.
It's the edit.
It's the edit that's the powerful part. And getting rid of the stuff that doesn't need to be there to create the masterpiece that then becomes the New York bestseller.
We do that in interiors all the time.
It's incredible.
You know, you take away, like you do your thing and then you take one piece away.
Oh, it's amazing. It's fascinating to listen. It's fascinating to listen and to that process and watch that process of a master craftsman. Mm-hmm. I love my old cars and the fabrication of a street machine that's just handcrafted for hours and hours and hours and hours, and the detail and the fold of the metal and the welder. Just watching that process is fascinating because it requires so much hard work, dedication, detail, mastering one's craft, all of that. And you see the end product, and people just see the end product. But they don't realize what's actually gone in behind the scenes to get to that point.
Yeah.
And for me, by doing this podcast, there's many similar podcasts, I guess, like this, but one of the things that I loved about this is uncovering what it takes for an Emma to get to where she is, a Tate to get to where he is, a Jim, a Michael, a George to get where they are in their particular fields, a Kate, you know, Sean, fantastic people all in their own right, in their own fields, but just – the part that fascinates me the most is what they've learned, how they've become the person they've become to get to that path in their particular career.
What their edit is, you know.
It's amazing.
Yeah. It's funny that you say that actually, because you sort of mentioned, you know, it's all, that people don't – they see the end product, they don't see, you know, the backstory or what it's taken to get there. And that kind of leads me to think about especially as a creative, you know, creative person, the value that as a creative, what you put on that, because, okay, I might, for example, style a home, you know, and people see, you know, okay, well, there's a staff of, you know, four on site that day and there's the value of the stock, and then that's how you should kind of price it. But it's also all that learning and all that effort and that curation and all that time and the expertise in putting that together. And I think creatives in general just don't put enough value on what we do.
That's right.
You know, because it's not the hours. I mean, people, it's not anything
new.
You're
paying for the expertise. You're paying for the time that you've developed, you've invested in. And it's a bit like I use this analogy of a pilot.
Mm.
A pilot analogy for me is the favorite one when someone says to somebody in their particular field, you're not worth what you're worth, or you're too expensive.
Yes.
And I asked the question, you know, when you're on a plane, pilots get paid a lot of money.
Mm.
But is a pilot in the air 100% of the time?
Mm-hmm.
The answer is no. The pilot's in the air a very small amount of time.
Yep.
Very, very small amount of time comparable to how often he needs to sleep and rest and learn and get better at his craft and in his field. But the time that the pilot's in the air with you on board and with your loved ones on board and with even strangers on board that you don't even know, he's busy saving your life based on his level of expertise, the thousands and thousands and thousands of hours that he has spent right in the air learning, honing his craft, getting better at what he does to ensure that he's safe and he gets you there safely. Does that make sense? So
it's his edit.
Yeah, but he doesn't get paid for the time that he's on the ground.
No.
Technically, right?
Yeah.
But without that time on the ground in his learning and going to school and all the rest of it, and then up in the air, it all comes together eventually. But you're essentially asking, you know, why he gets paid so much.
Well, yeah. That's why. Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting. Mm. And then on the flip side, I guess we've got our own weaknesses, and you sound like you're pretty self-aware person. You worked on that, and like we all continue to do. What do you think are some of your current weaknesses or weaknesses that you've had in the past that you still need work on?
I think for me, because of the upbringing, because of my personal trajectory and where I've come from, I find it very hard to switch off. Like when you've got that all-in personality, I'm constantly like, it's all about the business and the path and the legacy and where I want to be, you know, long-term and what I want to leave behind. I'm always thinking about that. So the hardest thing for me is switching off, because I love it. You know, like when you're doing what you love and you're following a path that's like coming from that, you know,
the right place,
you don't realize that it's contributing to your own burnout or it's contributing to that fatigue, you know. And it can be all consuming. So I'm making a conscious effort now and, you know, as we shift the business into like a new direction and, you know, we're again elevating into, you know, the next iteration of what it's going to look like. A big part of, you know, what I want to achieve in that is actually helping people down that journey that I'm currently on. You know, like let's learn together of what it actually looks like to have this balanced life. I talk a lot with our team and with Nick about like creating rituals for us and our family and, you know, ways to help me slow down, like little triggers that help me do that. Because I think if I didn't have that, I wouldn't naturally feel the need.
Mm.
I wouldn't naturally say, okay, Emma, it's time to slow down. You need a break. You need a rest. Like my family don't do that. Like it doesn't exist, you know, you just keep going. So I need to create that. Again, it's that same philosophy with the meditation. It's creating that space and that time to actually stop. So for me, it's little rituals. Like it might be, you know, lighting a bit of incense and like taking that moment to kind of, you know, have that in the morning and, you know, make a cup of tea and take that time to like be really present instead of just like kind of going to the next thing and rushing and, you know, not actually thinking about it. Even things like conscious eating for me is like a big one. Like I think I've really let my health go. Like this business has become everything for me. So in that you put yourself last. And again, it's that same pattern, isn't it? That's what my family do. They put themselves last.
But without you, the business doesn't go, does it?
Exactly. I've very, you know, much come to the realization probably in the last like 6 months that I really need to put myself first in order to be able to help the people around me get the very best out of themselves, yep. you know.
The old oxygen mask on the aeroplane again.
Exactly, yeah. Yep. So that's like the biggest one, I think.
Yeah, okay. What do you like with delegation?
I'm getting better at it. Yeah, I'm getting better at it. I struggle a lot because I think things sometimes come naturally, I think, to me. So it's easier just to do it yourself, you know. But it's having the right people and the trust in those people around you, I think. And it's taken me a long time to realize, like, what that, like, team actually looks like. And I'm at a place now where I've got, you know, a great bunch of people around me and I trust them enough and I've got that level of respect, I think, for them that I know that these people actually can do it better than I can, you know. So I feel comfortable delegating because I know it's going to get done.
Just while you're on that, how much then do you think – I guess a question with their notice in a way. How much do you think is your responsibility of putting the right person in the position – versus, I guess, the pressure that we put on the people that are in the position. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Cart before the horse, I suppose, sometimes. Do you think the skill level that the person demonstrates or their intuitive feel for what you're asking them or their initiative is of greater importance than the person that you initially chose? Whose responsibility is it for the success, really, is where I'm going with it. Is it your responsibility for choosing the right person, or is it that person's responsibility for being molded into that person? Does that make sense?
I think it's a little bit of both, but I think it's more so you need to have the right attitude. So when I'm hot, like before this, you know, business, I'd never hired someone before, you know. Whereas now, you know, I've done it. We've got a team now. There's 10 of us in the business and I've kind of done it a few times and we've had people come and go, obviously within that time. But I've learned that it's more about the attitude than the skill set. So, you know how I was saying before, like I'd rather someone that they don't have to be degree qualified to work. It depends on the role, right? But in styling, I don't need a degree for a stylist. I need someone who's willing to be coached, so that coachable kind of mindset. Are they willing to take feedback on? Because some creatives can be extremely
sensitive,
yeah, because it's very – like creativity, I think, is, you know, comes from a very, like, personal place. Yeah,
empathetic and there's a softness to it.
There is, yeah. And I think you know, if that's being criticized, because it is so personal when you're putting your creativity out there, if that's being criticized in any way, it's like you can get very defensive around it. So I think finding the people who are willing to learn and grow and be coached, that's like the most important thing. That's like really the key thing that in every part of our business, that's what I'm looking for. Yeah. And then it's my responsibility to make sure that if that person is coachable, and I wouldn't hire them if they weren't. So if they are coachable, then it's my responsibility to coach them, right? So to take them down and lead them on that journey to get the very best out of them. And to make sure you're checking in with them to do that, you know? And I think in business, it's so easy to just kind of go through the motions and like the day to day. And you sometimes don't have the opportunity to like give the people, which is, you know, it's so important that they're on the right path, but you need to make sure that you're kind of checking in with them and giving them that time.
Can't just let them float.
You can't. For their personal growth. And the better that they, obviously the better they get, the better the business is going to get. So you need to invest that time in them.
The Maltese blood in you. Can be fiery.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of our European blood in all of us can be fiery and combative and, like you said before, you know, somewhat, I don't know, defensive at times or whatever. How do you go about, are you better today at, you know, not taking things personally and sort of keeping emotions in check, or is that still something that comes out from time to time?
I think that definitely still comes out a bit more often than what I'd like.
Are you sort of conscious of it, or is it just kind of something that you've got to get out sometimes, or is it a thing that you're consciously working on?
I'm consciously working on it all the time. Yeah. Because I'll go from like, you know, 0 to 100, you know, and it's a conscious effort. And I don't mean to control, like it's not about controlling it or suppressing it or anything like that. It's about channeling it in the right way. Yeah. So you've got to be able to take that because it's at the end of the day, I look at it as passion, right? If you're really passionate about something,
care.
You care and you want it to be a certain way because you give a shit, you know? But it's how you express that and how you learn how to channel it into the right avenues to get a result, you know? So you can go crazy and, you know, have this like big blow up, but does it achieve anything?
You talked before about you know, something that you love so much, something that you're so passionate about, such as your industry, such as your business. I mean, how much does it burn when something doesn't go right? How do you deal with it? How do you handle it? I mean, how do you handle it, those significant setbacks? Because we all have them.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's been. I think in any industry, there's ups and downs and highs and lows. You know. Being that we're very closely linked, I mean, you know that the last few months of the year in real estate was a weird time, right? Like we went from being fully booked, calendars like pumping, like, you know, more jobs than we can handle, to then all of a sudden it's like, whoa, it's quiet. Like this is weird, you know? We haven't seen that in the industry for many years, you know, since when I first started. So that shift is a great example of that bit of adversity, right? It comes your way. And I think years ago when I first started the business, it would have defeated me. I would have just put my hands up and said, this is too hard. I can't cope, you know. I've got all these overheads. I've got all this staff that are counting on me, that are relying on me to be this leader in the business. And we've got no work for them. Like, what do I do, you know? And then now those things come and I think you've got to kind of – plan for them almost. Like you've got to be able to
be ready for them.
Be ready. Yeah. And you never know what they're going to be, right? So it's hard to plan for something that you can't control. But I just think being aware of it and then also having like different income streams as a business owner is really important.
You've diversified your business greatly, haven't
you? We have, yeah. Because over COVID we had to, you know, and then it kind of continues. So the design part of our business, you know, really came to life when the styling part of our business wasn't able to operate, for example. And then now we're able to, you know, channel it in a way, again, channeling that negative space into a positive. So now, you know, we continue all throughout the year, like that design part of our business is ongoing. So then when the styling is quiet and the market takes a turn, we're not in that scarcity mindset because there's a lot of styling businesses that at that time, like they'll, you know, really like race to the bottom, we'll cut pricing, we're going to do things super cheap, you know.
It's all they know, isn't it?
It's what else are they going to do? And I get it, man.
The discount mentality kicks in.
It does.
Which is not the right mentality to have. It's the one of upskilling.
Exactly.
Getting better all the time. And in your case, diversifying your business to multiple income streams that if something's shitting itself or the fan, shitting the fan in one capacity due to whatever, you're able to
channel it. And you've got something else.
Yeah.
You've got something else there to sort of sustain it, you know. I think that headspace is so important as a business owner. I've learned to really put that hat on in recent years because I've had to. You know. But if you don't, like I just don't – it's not you're not then running a sustainable business.
No,
because people are then going to remember, oh, she did it for this or, you know, that's the value then. That's the true. So you've got to be really careful, I think.
And importantly, it's the value then you have on yourself moving forward, you know, because you've done it once or you've done it twice.
And people want the easy way out too. Like they don't want to think creatively. They don't want to dig deep and, you know, look for other solutions because that's too hard. You know, it's hard to back yourself when – the chips are low, right?
Oh, yeah. Because, you know, the old mentality of, you know, burn the boats, that concept when countries used to get invaded, they'd get to the shoreline, they'd burn the boats and they'd go and attack the enemy because they didn't want there to be a plan B. You know, you hear people like Arnold Schwarzenegger when he gets interviewed and a lot of the time he said, there was never a plan B and no matter what he did in his career, like him or loathe him, for a variety of reasons, but he's the type of guy that doesn't matter what he did, bodybuilding, movies, politics, he tended to succeed and do pretty well out of all of them. I think his mentality was there's no plan B. If you have a plan B, then plan A is not going to work. So
yeah, exactly.
I think there's something in that. I guess what's you've got a pretty deep obsessive drive and a passion.
Mm-hmm.
What do you reckon is the cost of that?
I think the cost personally for me has been definitely like that I'm actively choosing the creative side of me. So then, you know, and I think it's that like I've got ADHD, right? So for me, my brain, the way that it works, and I am very late diagnosis. So through high school and it was never a thing, right? Very recent. And when you've got that like one track mind, when it's something that I'm passionate about, I'll do it all day and all night and not even think about anything else, right? But then it's the health that suffers. It's, you know, probably I don't want to say it's time with family because I make that a priority. Like I have to make that a priority and it's like an active choice again. But it's definitely health. It's myself. It's like, you know, not going to the gym and not looking after myself. And that's all the stuff that I'm working on now. I think it's also like friendships and those kind of relationships that aren't like at the top. Like for me, it's those like top priorities are like everything and there's nothing below that.
So it's kind of what for you would be, and I'm speaking on your behalf here, I don't know, like just would it be business and family or family and business in either order?
Yep.
And then pretty much daylight between whatever's next?
Yeah. So for
was
me,
that, was that a bit harsh?
No, it's true. It's like for me, you know, I think in my head it's family at the top and then business second and then there's nothing else. In reality, it probably is, you know, the reverse of that and it's kind of like it's business like at the top because it is more consuming, I think. But the older I get, the more time I give to, you know, making those conscious efforts and making those little decisions every day. To choose the life that I want to have and the life I want to have with my family. It's a big thing.
So when you say before as well about friendships or friends, have there been people that have been in your life before that are maybe not now or not as often now as you'd maybe like or consciously chosen?
Both.
Not to?
Yeah, both.
As a result of putting your focus to, you know, the business and family.
Definitely, yeah. I think, you know, certain relationships don't serve you and you need to let them go. You know, that's a given. But yeah, I think that like social kind of aspect, the last 12 months for us in the business has been like a huge period of growth and, you know, change and again, that pivoting and, you know, and all those sorts of things. So we haven't probably had the social life that we used to have either. And I miss, like you miss out on like a lot of, and, you know, you have that FOMO and I wish I was here and I wish I was there and whatever. Especially when you're working 6 days a week and we're renovating this and we're doing that and like there's so many moving parts in what we do, you can start to feel like, oh, I'm missing out on life, you know, I'm putting, you know, business first and, you know, career first and life second kind of thing, which is why I'm really making that effort now to learn to live differently. And that's why, you know, from the beginning of this podcast, I've spoken about going back to that simple kind of way of living that I crave that, you know.
Stripping things back.
Yeah. Yep. That life that my grandparents showed us that, you know, we probably looked at and thought that it wasn't a good life and it wasn't special and, you know, it wasn't this grand life. But I actually now think it's like the best life. You know, those simple things and those little daily moments. There's so much beauty in that simplicity. And that's really, the goal now.
So would you say you've got any regrets on your journey so far? And if you did, would there be anything that you'd do again if you had the chance or you're happy with the path that you've been on?
I think it wouldn't be fair to say that I have regrets because while it's been challenging at times and there's been like real lows, those lows have turned me into the person that I am and I've got the space now to make these decisions because of those difficult, challenging periods of my life. You know, there's always little things like, oh, we should have done this or we should have invested here or we should have, you know, bought that house instead of this one or, you know, what if we did that or what if we did this? But, you know, they're all those like sliding doors moments, right? Like your life would be potentially completely different. And would I have liked that life? I don't know. Maybe not, you know. If I didn't fall pregnant at, you know, 22 years of age, I now wouldn't have this amazing child who's like such a light in this world. And, you know, you've met him, like he's just, he's such a special kid. And if I had have gone down the route of that plan, then the pressure of us being in that financial situation wouldn't have allowed me to feel the need to get out of potentially real estate when I did and create this business and create this life. I wouldn't change any of it really.
Where does your deepest passion lie then when it comes to the business? It's multifaceted, mm-hmm. Triple threat, if you want to call it that. You've got the styling arm, which you do with us. That's how we met.
Yes.
I don't know if you remember how we met. I had a job in Sunshine in Matthews Hill. We're just on the edge of Matthews Hill on Duke Street. It was on the Braybrook side. I was trying to book my stylist that I was using regularly at that time. Just couldn't book it. I think it was right at the end of the year or right at the start of the year, one or the other.
Yeah.
Couldn't get them. And the vendor who I was selling for at the time said to me, look, I've got a lady up in Hoppers Crossing, I think, or Pop Point Cook. She maybe said, I can't remember what she told me. I'm going to use her. And I said, look, no problem. I just need someone and let's just get it done because we needed to get it listed and online and the rest of it. And at that time, I think you were called LV Interiors.
Yeah, we were LV,
That was your initial initial name. And that's how we came to be. So I don't know if you even remember that. I can't remember the number of the house, but beautiful house, brick, sort of that mustardy yellow, you know, 50s, 60s brick, beautiful house. It sold really well. Got a good outcome for the vendor and the purchaser's really happy. But that's how we came about. But you've got obviously the styling business. You've got property maintenance, which Nick, your hubby Nick and I sort of work alongside each other when we're selling properties. You know, because of preparing a lot of the properties that I'm fortunate enough to handle. And then you've got the design business. Once again, which you guys are helping design our current home.
Yes, we are.
Which we're about to build, which is super exciting. That's a saga in itself. That's a 2-hour podcast on its own, if you ask me. Those that know the intricacies of that know exactly what I'm talking about. But which out of those areas, where did your true passion deeply lie?
I think because I feel like I'm only just now really starting to know who I am as a person, you know, because I have had that kind of come up where it's all been like this crazy whirlwind life and experience. I never really had that time. Like we were speaking about it earlier where, you know, I didn't know who I was, you know. I'm only just figuring that out now. So it's only very recent, like in the last probably couple of years because of COVID, like thank you, this negative thing that we're able to, you know, take some positives out of. It gave me the opportunity to really discover like who I wanted to be and where I wanted this business to go. So through that kind of journey and this pivoting and this process, I've found that interiors for me and design for me is something I'm so passionate about, but it goes a little bit deeper than that. So I think interiors and design feels like a very superficial thing, right? It's like this surface level, it looks a certain way and that's what it is. For me, it's so much deeper than that. It's this really innate spiritual connection you have to the space that you live in. And I think it shapes you. I think if your interiors are a true reflection of who you are and who you want to be, then everything's in alignment. It gives you that opportunity to connect fully with who you are. And that's really what I want to help people achieve. And, you know, I'm learning all the time and, you know, really trying to be the best designer that I can be and have things align with my values. So we try and do things and educate our clients on longevity and sustainability and, you know, these things that like 10 years ago, I had no idea. Like it wasn't even in the conversation. You know, it wasn't important. It was all very aesthetic and very superficial. Whereas now it couldn't be further from the truth. I mean, it's all driven by values. It's like values-led design, you know. So for me, it's really connecting people with homes that are going to stand the test of time and have that patina and that ability to age and not be worthless to throw it in the bin in 10 years. You know, because that's the life cycle, isn't it? Like if you think of a home, you're in real estate, you get it. You buy a home, you know, townhouses that are built 10 years ago, are they still hot property now? You know?
Yeah, they need it. They They typically need a retrofit of some sort.
Yeah, they need a freshen up, update. You know, kitchen needs a renovation. Bathrooms might need a, you know.
Cabinets, floors.
Yeah, all these things. So I'm very much trying to design now with longevity in mind. And my parents are a great example of that. They built, you know, a mock Tudor house, you know, typical Wog mansion in Hoppers Crossing. It's stood the test of time though, hasn't it? You know, like you look at it now and it's not daggy or woggy, you know, well and truly it's 20 years down the line, you know, more. But it still holds that place and that sense of space. And, you know, period homes and like do that. And then I think they can be a bit bastardized, can't they?
Yeah.
You know, they go too far away from like what they were. So we try and design homes that, are really timeless and can grow with the people that live within the walls, and they don't need necessarily because of their style, they don't need to be replaced. So it comes back to that sustainable kind of mindset, I think.
I was just going to ask, where does that spiritual side of things come from? How's that connection been made with what you do? Where does that originate from?
I think it was born out of a place of necessity, because I think early days I was just at such a low like point where I didn't know myself. I felt really shit about, you know, the life I was living. I, you know, needed to get therapy because I was doing all these things and, you know, develops like a shopping addiction, for example, where like I want, like it was just that's what I'm talking about before with those dopamine spikes.
Is that right?
Yeah, which not many people know that about me at all. So, you know, peeling back the layers, I guess. But I did. It was just like I, you know, was filling the void in my life with material things. And it was unhealthy. It was really deeply unhealthy. And I got to a point where I just needed to look inward. So I, you know, started like listening to podcasts and doing all this self-work and got a business coach and, you know.
Just go back a step.
Mm-hmm.
What was the trigger though that gave you that self-assessment to realize, hey, I've gone too far with this?
Oh, was that
was
like,
it somebody or something that triggered that change in you?
No, I think it was just like the realization that, you know, Nick and I sat down and had a look at the bank balance and where all the money was going, and it was like this is before the business, you know, started. This is when we like still had no money and I was like spending what little money we had, you know. It was just horrible, you know, to look back on it, and sometimes it's that self-reflection and you're like, okay, well, yeah, this, and you add all this up and you're like, shit, really? Is it that bad, you know? And when it's like that addictive kind of behavior, and don't get me wrong, like it wasn't end of the world, you know, rehab kind of stuff. I'm not talking about that. It's just I was going down a very negative path where I was filling that void and, you know, that taking the control back by doing this thing, you know. And lucky we nipped it in the bud kind of thing, you know, but it could have gotten much worse if I didn't have that support network around me, and if there wasn't the visibility, I think too, from my husband realizing and whatever.
It's important.
Yeah, and people do it in different ways. Like you take control in different ways. For me, it was that, you know, it's addiction's one of those things, right? And I think for me, it was very much like that happened. I went and got therapy, learnt techniques during that time to kind of help recenter myself, and then it kind of grew very gradually from there. But it wasn't until, because it's been so go, it wasn't really until that lockdown kind of time where I had time and space to really delve deeper into it and, learn more about it and really follow, for the first time really ever in my life, follow something that's like purely something I'm interested in, that's not like money driven or success driven. It's like just comes from that place of I really want to do this, you know, I feel like I need to do this.
I'm trying to find something bigger than yourself to have as your North Star to aim towards.
Exactly. Good. So
when it comes to design, who are your greatest influences? Who are your greatest inspirations currently? And who are some of those people that have been before? I've spoken to you before about, you know, obviously we're doing our house and, you know, the style that we like. And Dream Makeover on Netflix with Shay.
Shay McGee, yes.
Yeah, Shay McGee. So
yep.
That's an amazing business, the Studio McGee. For those of you that know who I'm talking about, check her out. She's an amazing businesswoman, really cluey what she does. But Do you draw inspiration from her, or from people like her and businesses like hers? Because when I look at your business, mm-hmm. There seems to be like some degree of alignment with the type of businesses that I see.
Yep.
Not so much here, but in America for sure.
Yeah, I think locally, it's funny because really, and this will become very evident, I think, over the next 12 months when, you know, we release a few things and things change and so on within our business. But definitely within Australia, I don't think there's a lot of businesses or brands or designers who are aesthetically aligned. You know, I look at people like Amber Lewis, Amber Interiors, Jeremiah Brandt, Studio McGee, you know, brands like that. Sure, aesthetically, you know, they're on the same kind of page, I guess, like stylistically. But then I think like locally there's, you know, some like sustainable architecture firms and things like that where I draw inspiration from, not necessarily the aesthetic of what they're doing, but the meaning to their work. Mm. And we're trying to blend almost the two and bring like a uniquely Australian, I suppose, take on that that European kind of an American sort of style. But it's constantly evolving, and I think as a designer you want to make your own impact. So, you know, there's probably similarities in certain things that we do from a design sense, but I think really I don't take a lot of inspiration from like other designers. It's more inspiration from the materials. That's probably the biggest thing. So like we'll have all of our suppliers, for example, and like our design process is very much like we'll sit down and do all the pre-work. Like pre-work's a big thing for us. So, you know, with our clients, like we send out like all the questionnaires, you've got to do all of that work. And, you know, we really want our clients to get a good understanding of what they want to achieve out of their project before we even sit down for that initial meeting. So it's getting them to, as a family or, you know, partners or whatever, an individual, to be really clear on your intention for your project. So we take that as inspiration, obviously, because it's about the people, right? You know, it's not about necessarily just the end product. It's about you living in your home. How do you live in the home? What does it look like for you? What's important? What are your values? What are your beliefs? Like, you know, what are we designing for, you know, first and foremost? And then you take that and then you mix it with the materials and then you know, able to create something that blends that individual person's aesthetic, so the things that you like personally. So with your place, like you guys really love that, you know, Americana kind of vibe, right? That American modern
farmhouse
yeah. you know, sort of style and aesthetic. So we'll take elements of that, but then I think we add our own kind of spin to it. Mm. You know, that's the biggest thing. I think as a designer, you've got to always push the envelope, because if we're talking about, you know, even with our look, like if someone comes to me and says, oh, I really love what you did with Brank's place, like it's stunning, you know, can we recreate that? Like my answer's kind of no. You know, we it's kind of already been done. Like we don't want to do the same things over and over.
Personalized to that person.
Yeah.
The end user.
We're trying to create something that like reflects the people within the walls, right? Mm. So, yeah, we take a lot more inspiration from outside.
And particularly the detail elements, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And that sets you apart, you know. So anyone can take an image, you know, anyone can get inspiration these days. It's abundant. It's everywhere. You know, Pinterest and Instagram and all these things. If you want a certain aesthetic, it's not very difficult to find it, and to recreate it is easy. What's difficult is to make sure that the things that you're creating, and it doesn't have to be completely innovative every single time. I'm not talking about that. But I'm talking about having it actually reflect who you are, so that it does feel like it's your home and not just like this display home. Mm. You know, making it work for you functionally, bringing in the elements of who you are to it, you know. So, for example, you know, we, when designing, put a huge emphasis on like the materials and the finishes and all of that. But really it's the end, that end and final piece of the puzzle with the styling that make it someone's like true home. So it's taking those things from like your travels and those elements of the world and the life that you've lived and incorporating them into your home, so it feels like it's not a staged property,
yeah.
you know, and it's a home.
And I think too, like when you walk into a cluttered home, and it's not to be judgmental. Everybody has a right to live how they want, but my understanding of how that person lives doesn't click. It doesn't make sense because I'm like, well, there's like stuff everywhere, or someone that's like super, super, super minimalist, like. Yep. There's barely anything there.
Yeah. Then doesn't have their personality.
By choice. Yeah. Sometimes it's a bit stark and bare.
A lot of it has to do with like planning, you know, and when you're not able to design a home from scratch and go through that design process that we would go through with, for example, our clients, you're not thinking about or you haven't had the opportunity because it's an existing home to really think about the functionality. When the functionality is right and the storage is right and the way and we understand clearly what our clients need to live their best, most successful life, all of that's incorporated into the design. So, you know, there's room, for example, for everything to be really neatly organized so that you can have that clean, clear aesthetic. You know what I mean? Whereas if you're just moving into a house and there's no room to store stuff, because it hasn't been put there, because it hasn't been built there. Like, you've got to work with what you've got, right? And that's where sometimes people get stuck.
And do you reckon there's a timeline, or is it different for every product? Or is there a specific timeline involved in getting something right?
I think for us as designers, it doesn't take that long anymore because we've got the process right and we know the questions to ask. But I think people doing it on their own, you're doing it for the first time, it's very easy to muck it up, you know. You're probably in a unique situation because you see a lot of homes and you see where, you know, the strengths are and you can learn from that. But for the average, our average client has no idea, you know. They know what they want it to look like, but they don't, you know, necessarily have much thought really past that. So it's kind of my job to educate them, you know, on what they need and to get them to think about their life. And that's what I was saying before with all the pre-work. Yeah, so it's not about a certain amount of time. I think it's more the process.
Do you think there's a great deal of understanding from so after a client's been through that preparation process, if you like, do you think there's a greater understanding from the client of what you guys need to do next as far as the actual designer is concerned, or do you think they're still oblivious to a certain degree as to what the designer needs to go through to get to what the client actually wants to see at the end of it?
Yeah, I think they have a greater appreciation for what's involved because it's so overwhelming, I think, like when you're sort of embarking.
It's so overwhelming. I can speak from experience.
Yeah, it's a lot, you know. So we try and like hold our clients' hands, you know, through the process and take that kind of burden and that pressure off them. And what I've learned now compared to early days, again, like it's this evolution, right? Like we're a lot better now than what we were when we started. So, you know, now I try not to overwhelm people with options. So we'll, you know, do that pre-work, we'll take that questionnaire into account, we'll have that initial meeting, we'll develop the brief. And then from there, when we're presenting for the first time, we try not to give people too many options. You know, we try and more narrow down like what they like and don't like. But by that stage, I've already done all of this pre-work, this really detailed preparation before we, you know, sit down with the initial concept. So I know what's right for them probably more than what they do. And it's about working with the right people too, because you can have someone who wants to listen to that advice and wants to, you know, learn through this process and has that faith in you to deliver the outcome, which is why they're working with you. Or you can have people who are constantly going to be questioning it, you know, because they're unsure or whatever, no matter what you do.
It's the nature of the beast though, right?
Yeah. So yeah. We try and be very selective about who we're working with and to make sure, not just for us, but also for them, that we're the right fit, you know.
It's interesting you say that, like as a parallel to our industry, vendors that let you do your job because they've employed you to be hopefully the best agent for the job of their choosing. The agents that are allowed to just do their job at the best of their capability, at the height of their powers without too much – when I say interference, I say it respectfully to vendors, but it's when an agent's just allowed to do what they – it needs to be priced this way, this is how we need to present it, XXX, right?
Yes.
Things just fall into place and you tend to get a really good outcome. Those vendors that let go tend to be the ones when they just rely on you and you know, allow you to just do your thing, being flow, if that's probably the right word.
Yep.
you tend to get the best outcomes. The ones that are a little bit more overbearing, that I don't know that we should quote it that way. Or, I want you to. It's like, you know, well, when you go to the doctor or when you go to a surgery, you don't say, "Hey, Mr. Surgeon or Mr. Doctor, you know, hey, I don't think you should be cutting there. I think you should be." You know, does that make sense? And,
yes.
And I think it's a bit similar in your field when somebody 100%. Just lets you do what you do because you're bloody good at it.
Yeah.
Good things will tend to happen, and it's when there's that interference. It's coming from a good place.
Yeah.
Because they – it's not necessarily they don't trust you, but I think there's a sense that they feel as though they still want to have some sort of involvement in the process.
Yeah.
But you're just giving them, in your process, involvement up front.
Exactly. And right? That's the biggest – we don't get the pushback that probably some other designers do because of that initial process, yeah. Right? So – early days, I didn't do all that pre-work, and like we had, you know, our initial kind of meeting, and it was very brief, and it was, you know, this is what we want, and this is the inspiration that I have, and this is what we, you know, trying to achieve, and then we would present, and then you'd get a lot more pushback because you haven't done, I don't know these people.
Mm.
Like, you're inviting me to design your home for your family. Like, that is so intimate to
me. So personal, and it's so permanent.
It is.
It's very difficult to undo.
Yeah.
Without going to a great deal of cost and effort and time and energy.
And people, it's highly emotional. Like, when you're talking about someone's dream home, we're not talking about like an investment property that, you know, it's got to fit a purpose or, you know, sometimes like we'll do businesses, for example, there's not that same level of emotion when you're fitting out a business to if you're fitting out someone's forever home for their family, right? So, if I don't know you and I haven't taken the time to get an understanding of who you are, or if you haven't, and this is where we weed out clients we probably don't align with and we can't work with, if the client isn't receptive to doing the work to the level that we need them to commit to and to be open and, you know, allow the process to happen in the way that we've designed it and constructed it to happen, we know we're not going to be able to work with them.
It's never meant to be
the right fit. Yeah. No, yeah. Because it's such an integral, and we set it up like that, you know, with every client early on. This is the most important part of your entire build or your entire design journey is this piece of paper that you're going to fill in, you know. We've done it all, so it's very easy for people to do online now. Like, we're, you know, at the forefront, like with all of that stuff, with the technological advancements for our industry, like we're right on top of everything. So it's easy now for people to do it, but you just need to set it up. You know, it's the same for you guys. Like, you've got to set up your vendors to help them succeed. If you don't tell them what they need to hear and set up that process for them and give them that assurance of your process, how do they know that you're any good?
They don't know.
They don't know. They haven't seen, you know, they've seen your results maybe, but they've never been a part of that process. So, yeah, that's the most important thing really for us.
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic, isn't it, when you really strip it back.
Mm.
When you really strip it back.
Yeah.
They're
not going to trust you. The takeaway there is people won't trust you unless you teach them how.
Yeah, and unless you demonstrate some level of competence and probably also past experience as well.
Yeah, and you've got to push back on them a little bit too. You know,
in the right way. Yeah, I know what you mean.
It's like herding. It's herding them in because, especially with design, people have a million ideas. They love a million different things. You know, they love mid-century. They love Art Deco. I love this. They'll give me inspiration on their Pinterest, and it'll be a million different. Completely different looks and feels and all of that. So you've got to be able to guide them and also have it not jar against the house that they've got, especially with a renovation. Like, you've got to be really careful that there's some cohesion, you know. It's not bastardizing that project. Yeah.
And then on the styling and maintenance side of things, we spoke before about often that tends to be a bit of an introduction to some clients.
Yes.
For you guys as a business.
Yes, it is.
When it comes to Elevate, the property styling that we as agents would employ you guys to do for us, getting property set up and then sometimes prepared through the maintenance side of the business with projects, can sometimes be something probably less, maybe less, bit less lucrative for you guys, maybe financially, possibly.
Yep.
maybe it's a bit more of a long-term view. And I think you guys seem to have more of a long-term view about your business every time I work with you guys. And
everything that we do.
And I think it's the right outlook to have, rather than, you know, burn a bridge here or burn a bridge there for the sake of a deal here and there. It doesn't seem to be the way you guys operate. And we're in alignment like that, where it's, you know, client first, process and everything, and, you know, the financial reward will come down the track.
That's
a byproduct of doing the right thing by the person. George and I spoke about that just recently. You know, Jim's spoken about that. It's a common theme amongst good business practitioners, no matter what field you're in. Look after people and everything else will come to you in spades. How do you guys view your business collectively, and what is your business looking like moving into the future? From a structural standpoint.
Yeah, sure. So I think from the outside looking in, I think people look at property styling businesses and think, wow, like they must be making a packet of money, like they're charging, you know, like thousands of dollars like per install, and look how many they're doing a week, and like look at this amazing business and this amazing team. And it certainly is, and, you know, it's a profitable, you know, business, but it's taken a very long time, you know, and a huge – financial investment.
So how much stock would you have to buy at any one time? So let's say you did a, I don't know how many houses you can style at once, 20, 30, 40, 50, I don't really know. But
yeah, so we're sitting at 40.
So 40, okay, so 40 homes. So how much would it cost to go out and buy the stock to be able to supply styling for 40 homes?
Well, per house, like depending on the size of it, per house it can range anywhere from $30,000 to probably $80,000.
So that's in the house. Stock that's sitting inside one of the houses that you style for us or another agent.
Correct.
Yeah, sure.
And you wouldn't have ever thought it was that high.
I wouldn't have thought it's that high.
But you've got it, like,
respectfully.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have thought.
Yep. And that's like, we buy stuff at wholesale too. But if you add it all up, right? If you think about every single thing that's in that house, and we try and do things to a level of quality that aligns with our values as well, right? Because I'm a values-led business. So, you know, we're not buying stuff from companies that don't have like sustainable practices, or it's like I'm not buying stuff from like IKEA or, you know, Kmart or things that are going to fall apart in 5 minutes. I'm trying to buy furniture that is going to last, right? So when you're trying to do things ethically, again, like it becomes even more costly than doing things in an unethical way, right? So we're buying this stuff at wholesale. If you look at like an average, like say an average house is like a 3-bedroom, you know, 1 living house. That's probably that. Would you say that's the average kind of size home that we do with you guys?
3-bed, 2-bath probably.
Yeah. And then, you know, you're talking about like 10 rotations worth of homes, and that's in there for like 6 weeks at a minimum usually. It's like very rare, especially these days, for something to sell like within a couple of weeks. It's taking longer.
Yeah.
So think about how many rotations. That's, you know, 60 weeks potentially that stock has to exist without even paying wages, without even paying your overheads for, you know, your factory or your truck or loans or anything like that. Just for the stock component itself, you're talking about like 60 weeks. Like, and there's not 52 weeks of the year that are counted as like profitable weeks. You know what I mean? Like January's not like busy from halfway through, and December you're probably busy only till about the 15th of December every year. You know what I mean? So you got to take that whole month out of the equation per year. So you're talking about 60 weeks where that stock makes you zero money before you pay wages per property. So you're going to want to keep it. The stock needs to be kept for like...
So what's the rotation of it? 2, 3, 4 years, 5 years? What's the lifespan of some of the stock that you buy today?
If you run a business that is trends-based, so there's stylists out there that'll just do everything that's like super trendy and like current and like, you know, that disposable approach, they'll get maybe 3 years out of their stock max, right? And then it fades and it's like shit quality, so, you know, they're not going to get much longevity like out of it anyway. We try and stretch that, you know, to sort of 4 or 5 years, because the style in which we're buying stock, again, it's more timeless. Like I'm trying to buy quality pieces that are going to stand the test of time, as opposed to early days in the business, we couldn't afford to buy anything that, you know, had that longevity. And I've learned that that's not the right way. You know, we're evolving and changing all the time. But it's the point is, unless you're running a property selling business in a really clever, considered way and running it like a business and not like a hobby, it's not a highly profitable industry.
You're just installing on its own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just not, you know, because you've got to, if you give a shit about what you're doing, you have to continually buy stock and that investment is just so massive, you know, all the time. Storing it, wages, truck, so all the outgoings.
You've got to buy a warehouse or you've got to rent one somewhere. Or
exactly. And so rent that for that amount of, you know, amount of stock is not cheap. Like it all kind of adds up, right? So for us, we've always looked at the property styling. Well, not always. Over the last 5 years, I've looked at the property styling arm of our business as a marketing strategy, essentially, because it's the best one because the leads aren't just warm, they're hot. Mm. You know, this is our exact market. Like we're talking to people who are buying and selling and transacting in real estate who are going to need help fitting out and furnishing their homes, right? It's just the natural progression of it. And from it being purely furnishing for many years, we've now evolved as the team's grown and as we've put on, you know, specialists that are amazing designers who are more technical, for example. Like once that sort of started happening, we started moving into working with architecture firms and, you know, really honing in and developing that higher level of design as opposed to just furnishing, right? But, yeah, it's funny how there's so many, like, young businesses that start out in this industry and think it's just fluffy and it's easy and I'm just going to buy some furniture and put it in a house and, you know.
A lot of parallels to real estate.
Yeah.
People think that's easy too.
Yeah. And it's not until you're in it and, you know, you're like right in it and it's like full on and you realise it's maybe a little bit different to that.
Mm. You know? Do you collaborate with other designers, other stylists around Melbourne? And
oh, absolutely.
What are your relationships like with, let's say, your competitors?
Yep. So we refer business and get referred business from other stylists all the time. So we've got
how does that work?
So we try and keep, like, geographically, it doesn't make sense for me to travel to the southeastern suburbs to do an install every you know, day, for example. Mm. Like, it's not going to we don't have the time to be able to do it, right, travel and this, that. So we partner up with other stylists that work in other areas. So when they've got a lead that might come in that's in our geographical location, like, we'll do it and vice versa, right?
Why don't you just both take a cut of the fee or something like that, or not? Sometimes not even.
Not even. No, it's just a straight, you know, goodwilled referral. Generally,
even better.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it goes both ways. Like if you're helping people and they're willing to help you, and you know, I've been very big on when you say competition, like in our immediate, you know, geographical kind of location. If a new stylist comes up, I'll usually give him a call and take him out for a coffee and kind of give him the run of the land a little bit. Oh,
would you? Really?
Yeah. Okay. Oh, 100%. Yeah. Because I think you run the risk if you don't do that of that race to the bottom.
So what would you discuss with him in that meeting, just out of interest?
I'm so like transparent. And, you know, people might think I'm weird for doing it, but like I want them to know, hey, like this is what I charge. This is where it's at. This is what you should do to succeed in your business. I don't see them as competition financially. Like they're not a threat to me.
Is that something done with other businesses? I mean, where did you come up with that concept? Have you seen it in another industry that you thought that's a good idea? I might just pinch that.
I don't know where it came from, honestly.
It's good. I like it. I think
I just think it's probably, you know, that scarcity versus abundance mindset.
Yeah.
And who knows, I probably heard it in a podcast, like, I don't know. But I've just always done it. I don't see people as competition, direct competition, as a threat to me. I see it as this person can either be someone who elevates our industry or someone who pushes it down. And if they're going to push it down, I don't want them to do that. What's the reason for that?
They probably won't last long anyway.
No.
In all honesty.
But they leave the scar, you know, behind.
Yeah.
So I'd rather help lift them up and say, hey, you know, if XYZ or if someone's, you know, got a style, for example, that suits your furniture better than it suits mine, I'm happy to refer you that work. You know, this is where I'm sitting at, you know, kind of price-wise, just so that you're aware. Because early days, like I had, you know, agents try and dictate to me what I should be charging. You know, oh, you should be charging this. This is what our other stylists charge. Yeah, their stock might be different or
– so they're just bouncing you figures. Off them.
Well, yeah. Not even – I think it's just like, you know, there was a couple of instances I think where – you know, you'd go out and you'd do your BDM and you want to work with new agents and they'd be like, oh, well, our current stylist charges this. And I think as a woman in business, and I don't want to speak for women in general, but like for me early days, I didn't have the confidence to, you know, I didn't know my self-worth, I didn't know my value. So I would just be like, oh, okay, if that's what they're charging.
You thought you might
like,
get shot down otherwise.
And yeah, I really want to work with them. Like they look like a really great business. Yeah. Like, okay, well, I'll just have to figure out how to make it work for that price, you know. Whereas now that's not the case. Like I know exactly what each job costs me to do and what it needs to be at. And I'd rather walk away from a job if I'm not getting remunerated, you know, fairly for the amount of effort and the expertise and the stock level that we've got. Sometimes it's better to walk away and take a different job, you know.
Agree. You've got to value who you are as a professional. Otherwise, as we said before, use that, you know, when we're talking about the pilot example and whatnot. If you don't, if you don't value yourself, it's very rare that the client will value what you do. And the clients typically see through that desperation. If you're, like you said, the race to the bottom. If you're cutting costs and using that discount mentality and that scarcity and fixed mindset as opposed to the growth and abundance mindset.
Exactly. For us, it's that coupled with visually, you see it.
Mm.
You can't. There's no way. Like you'll go broke so quick in this industry. Yeah. You know, if you've got high quality stock and you're charging like very low or, you know, like there's stylists, honestly, like I've heard stories out there where stylists are making $100 like per job.
That's a point.
And that's it. What's the point? Well, you're going to do all that work to make $500 a week.
How much do you reckon over your 7 or 8 years being in business for yourself, how much do you reckon you've financially invested in buying stock?
Oh, it's probably like over $2 million. Over the years,
wow.
It's a lot. And no one knows, like, but it's a lot.
Yeah, shit.
Yeah.
It's significant money.
It's significant.
That's more than
huge.
I would have ever thought, to be honest.
What it is a lot of the money that comes
in. That's just the stock, though? Just the stock?
Just the stock, yeah. Just the stock. Because it comes in and then it goes out too, you know. Like, it's such a overhead-heavy business.
Yeah.
Yep.
Because it's the physical asset that provides the service, but you need the physical asset
and like,
as part of that service, which you need investing.
Furniture is worth so little after, like the second, it's like a brand new car, right? When you drive it off the showroom floor, like who wants a secondhand couch?
Yeah.
You know, they're not going to want to pay what it's worth. Like it's worth next to nothing. You know, if you go on Marketplace, there's sofas that are not that old that are worth nothing because they're secondhand, right?
Yeah.
So that's why we've really started to shift the way that we do our buying so that these pieces have that longevity. It's a better business model for us, but it's also better for the environment and it's more values aligned, yeah.
Where are you typically sourcing most of your stock from? Is it mostly in Australia or overseas or a combination of both?
It's mainly local. So early days when shipping containers were not $20,000.
That's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, crazy. We did a bit of that from overseas and, you know, now it just doesn't align with the direction of the business and what we're trying to create here.
And the quality of the product is diminished as well.
Exactly, yep. So, you know, in saying that, we still source from brands that get their stock overseas. But when we do, we make sure that those pieces are pieces that we can have for a really long time and aren't going to disintegrate, you know, very quickly, yeah.
Yeah, you've got to invest heavily. And then on the flip side, so while you've got to buy the stock, you've got to store the stock.
Yes.
Right. So part of your storage is obviously in the houses that you're styling. So that's part of the
smartest way to do it.
That's a good way. But part of it you need to have storage. So you've got to have a facility, a warehouse or a factory or something like that. And then just the concept of and you know, the reality of theft. And insurance and things like that.
Yes.
I mean what part does that play in have you had instances where you've had, I don't know, I laugh at the story that Nick said, you know, where your house is looked like it was robbed. But how many instances are there where you've ever been had a whole house pinched or part of it? Or is it a commercial reality, or is it just more something that's surface level?
No, it's such an issue.
Is it?
Yeah.
How do you protect yourself?
So we have insurance. We've got general property insurance, and, you know, it's great and it protects us and it's there. But the problem is, once you've had a certain amount of claims, it's very tricky because then the insurers don't want to
reinsure
you. Because it's this huge liability. Like if you've got, you know, a claim and people have broken in and taken $20,000 out of a house and you're putting a claim through for 20 grand, like the insurers don't want to be paying that out, you know. We have been hit 3 times this year. So this year's been particularly bad, but then I've had years where, you know, nothing's happened. Sometimes things get damaged or broken or whatever. There's a lot of styling companies out there that don't have adequate insurance and they put it back on the homeowner, you know. So their expectation is that the homeowner has the insurance. They have contents insurance that covers their the business's property, which they're not like forthcoming about. So if that was to happen, then the homeowner would have to figure that out, right? With us, we do everything in-house. So people are fully covered and fully insured no matter what the circumstances are, you know, we, you know, put a huge emphasis on that level of security, I think, for our vendors and that peace of mind. But, yeah, it's such a huge issue and, you know, it's such a big hit, and emotionally it's like, you know, this collection that I've curated over, you know, my career in this business, a lot of them have this like sentimental element to me, and then someone comes in and it's very violating. Like imagine being robbed.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and then that happening like so regularly, it's like, yeah, it feels gross.
Like you've got a target on your back in a way.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. Yeah. But yeah, it's part of it. You know, when you've got 40 houses out at any one time, it's kind of a numbers game, isn't it? Mm. Like it's going to happen. It's really shit when it does. We're going through a claim at the moment. I'm still waiting. It's been like 3 months. I'm still waiting on insurance to like clear the funds. They're dragging their feet and it's just been a nightmare. But yeah, it happens, unfortunately.
Well, it sounds like you guys are well placed. I mean, the market's the real estate market, the economy in general has been, you know, it's in a somewhat suppressed, if you want to call it that. I won't say depressed just yet. Some would say we're in a depression or heading towards a depression, but yeah, let the economists tell us that officially at some point.
Yes.
But it sounds like your business is structured in a way now, where you've set it up or grown it in a way and diversified it in a way where when the downturn
it's a more sustainable business model.
Yeah,
I think.
Once it bounces back, I think you guys are ready to sort of roar, ready to rock and roll, and you'll be ready to launch pretty quickly, whereas maybe others – maybe they haven't had that investment or made that investment or maybe changed their business model.
They're not real businesses.
Yeah. So
they're like hobbies. You
know, yeah.
A big part of our industry is that, because you don't have to be qualified to join, or you don't, you know, you've just got to be able to afford furniture to start, you know. So a lot of them are set up not thinking about all of the, because they might not know at the time. I don't hold, like at the beginning, I had no clue either, you know. But for us, it's like, we were talking about it before, there's no plan B, there's no backup plan. Like Nick's now involved in the business. We've been able, very fortunate, to grow the business to a point where, you know, my husband, who is ex-commercial construction and was earning, you know, great money at the time, but lifestyle was a huge, you know, negative factor for us as a family. We made the decision for him to come across to the business. So now there's no backup plan. Like this is it. We need to make this work. So as a result of that, I think, you know, for us, things are very much, even though it's not innately my strength, like I'm not like a numbers maths kind of person, I've had to learn to be and to really plan things out very strategically in order for the business to be able to endure these kind of
downturns.
Yeah.
And then just going back to what we asked before about influences, you said before, I don't really have any significant influences.
Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you, is it part of that? Is it because you don't want other people to necessarily influence you in a way where you become them, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I want to make my own mark.
Yeah, you want to make your own, be individual in your own right. Yeah.
I'll take more inspiration from industries outside of our.
Ah, got it.
Yeah. So it might be, you know, artists, or it might be fashion designers, or it could be something as simple as like a textile. You know, I'll take inspiration from a piece of fabric that I've seen, you know.
And transfer that across to your industry and work out a way to sort of bring
Yeah. Because I think the second that you start just, especially in interiors, if there's these people who are like heavily influencing you and you're like visually taking in and absorbing their work all the time, your work is just their work.
You become an incarnation of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it can be in the creative field, I think. I'm no expert in this, clearly in that field, but it seems like you don't want to become – a carbon copy of the next person, because it's in the creative field. The whole purpose of it is to be different and to let individualization shine.
Yeah, well, we're in this weird industry where people are paying for my brain.
That's your IP. Yeah, that's your IP.
They're paying for that creativity and you know and that process. Yeah. I guess. So if I'm just replicating someone else's work, like it's kind of not on. So I'll take it more from you know music, or it'll be just like a little thing in those questionnaires where people will say. Something, sometimes it's just something really random, like, you know, like say a car or something, or I've got this cool car and I love the color of it or whatever. And then I'll just use that as inspiration. Mm. So yeah, I'm finding inspiration always everywhere.
It's good to hear. Mm. Yeah. It's good to, and it's inspiring to hear when people use other industries and they transfer that across to their industry to work out how they can make it better.
Mm.
And use some of those inspirations. No doubt you've made mistakes along the way. There have been challenges. There have been failures. There have been fuck-ups.
Mm.
What's the biggest one you think you've experienced and biggest learning from it, and how'd you overcome it from a professional standpoint?
Probably the biggest mistake I made when I look back on it was putting – other people's needs and wants before my own, I think.
As far as clients are concerned or?
No, like probably just like external influences, I guess. It's like those, you know, the real estate agents early on who kind of told us what we're worth.
Okay. Letting it impact your mindset.
Yeah. Yeah.
Letting it get in your head.
Exactly. Sort of, or like looking, you know, early days, like looking at our like – inverted commas, like competition or like what other people are doing and letting that determine.
This conversation we pretty much just had about.
That's probably the worst thing.
Letting others probably influence what you're doing.
Like honestly, there hasn't really been outside of that, I don't look at anything else as like a major fuck up because I think I've learnt so much from it that I, you know, it's like we're going back to like kind of the same thing, but it's led to what the business now is. So, and I'm grateful for where it is now. So I'm very reflective on that journey and that process. I don't know that we would be here today if I hadn't have allowed, I didn't make those decisions. Yeah.
Got to go through it, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a few things that I reckon you do pretty well. I mean, we've worked with each other now, like I said, since what, 2017, I reckon?
Maybe 16.
If it was LV back then, that's how long.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it hasn't been LV for a long time.
No. That's right.
So a few things that I think you just is from my take on it, right across the table. So, I reckon. I mean, and today's discussion's been, you know, tremendous, and it's really brought out a lot of the things that I already think about you and your business. And I reckon you got a great deal of courage.
Mm.
I reckon you got a shitload of courage in.
Thank you.
In the concept of going all in. You know, it does take a lot of temerity, a lot of, you know, balls to the wall type mentality. Mm. That if it does fail.
Mm-hmm.
Shit, you know, what do we do next?
Yeah.
And I think from that point of view, you've got a substantial appetite for risk.
Mm, I think so.
You know?
I honestly put that down to, you know, early days, real estate days, like I said, Chantel put me in touch with Josh Fegan. So he was my sort of real estate coach, you know, back in the day. And it's always really stuck with me. I think I've mentioned it that many times in this podcast already, but that scarcity mindset, like he introduced me to that. Mm. So that fear and scarcity mindset and how much it can hold you back. So I've really tried to make an active decision over the years to not choose scarcity and to choose abundance, you know, and that's a lesson that I learned from him. So I can attribute that to.
And Josh, again, for those that don't know who Josh Fegan is, Josh is one of the foremost real estate trainers in the country, arguably the best.
Yeah.
Many people use him as the go-to mentor trainer on a regular basis and so much so over the years that He's like we said before, he's Alexander Phillips's coach, who's the number one agent in the country. That's how good he is. And Josh knows his stuff, also an ex-agent. His father was an estate agent, so Josh knows his shit. So really good guy and really, really switched on. So the people that you've lent on for advice and mentorship have been really, really good. I ask you the question, do you worry a lot when I say some of the things that you do? Because I think maybe initially you're probably worried a bit, but it sounds like you've really worked on yourself and self-reflection. Mm-hmm. So I think you've become exceptionally good at self-reflection. I asked you the question before about meditation when you brought it up. I think just that's a great example of you having the understanding of needing to self-reflect and look back on things. And as a result, like, I've written here, it's all part of that creative path, that creative process, the entrepreneurial journey to get to a point. You've got to work on yourself as much as you've got to work on your business.
You do.
And you sort of said before that's one of your weaknesses, which sounds like you're aware of it, you're working on it. But I think the more you build on that, I think your business is going to get even stronger.
I think I've learned to not do things because I do value time so highly. I've learned to not do things that aren't going to be conducive to a positive outcome. So if I worry and just sit here and rattle my brain and have, allow anxiety, which, I've suffered from really debilitatingly in the past, if I allow that to take over and I don't do the things that help me overcome it, I'm wasting time. It's not going to me worrying isn't going to change shit.
And isn't it true? The quicker we realize that all anxiety is, it's a fear of something that hasn't happened yet.
Yeah,
that's all it is.
Yeah,
right. And the quicker we come to terms with that and have that realization, that's easy for me to sit here and say that, right?
Yeah.
But someone that like you that's been through it, and people that are working through it, people listening to me right now saying, "Well, fuck you, mate. You don't even know what I'm going through."
Yeah.
But that's how I see anxiety. I look at it as being worried about stuff that hasn't happened yet. And it's like a worry wart in a way. But if we can, again, it's that consciousness of being aware of it and dealing with it. But it's much easier said than done.
Much easier said than done. And I think sometimes if you, again, don't have the space or the luxury of time to be able to deal with it and you don't know or have the resources available to you to figure out how to overcome it or to, implement those little things, or you don't have the willingness to kind of try new things to figure out what works for you or I think it's so layered because,
It's not a simple thing.
For me, I've found that, having a willingness to get the right help and seek out the things that help me personally has been really beneficial. But it, even now it kind of, it still comes, like it still rears its ugly head, but I've got the tools in place. I know how to handle it. It's always like, it's always there. It's just, knowing that if I don't implement these things, I'm not going to be able to move past this, this fit of anxiety, and it doesn't serve me and it's not.
It just holds you back, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah. And it's so debilitating. Yeah.
And then probably the last thing that I think, you do really well, and in fact, I'd almost argue the point to say I reckon it's something that you've now in your mind that you've mastered. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned it earlier, I think really early in the podcast, and I've never looked at it like this with you because I've never really had this deeper conversation with you before. But and it is that in a way you've created, maybe your dad's done it, unknowingly, but created a system where your whole family's involved in a business, right? So dad's had your brother there. But what you've done, you've tied it all back now. Now, you almost seem like the center point of the family business, family businesses, I should say, and that you're creating, you used the word before, legacy.
Yeah.
Right? One thing I love that you mentioned before, we talked about grandparents, parents to you, to your kids, or your child, Andre. I love the fact that you're creating a legacy for your family, and it's creating full involvement from everybody. Everybody's involved in some capacity, some way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
The answer is, I think, is obvious, but let me ask you, why, Emma, is that family legacy so important to you, and that concept of having everyone involved that you love so dearly?
I think every person, no matter if it's your chosen family or if it's your genetic family or your network or your friendship group, whatever it is, right, the most successful people on the planet know how to lean on other people for support, right? I'm extremely fortunate that for me, that support network happens to be my family. And I don't take that for granted, not for one second. But yeah, definitely for me, it's been, you know, leaning on them. And then now that I'm at this point in my career where we get the opportunity to work with these people that I love and bring them in and lean on them in a work sense as well. Like, why wouldn't I do that?
What a privilege, hey?
Yeah, it's an honour. It really is. And, yeah, I think the legacy component of it for me is really about my parents, you know, really broke that, and my grandparents to an extent, but they, like, broke that cycle of poverty. So they kind of changed the game for our family, you know. Before them, it was the same for a really long time, you know, for generations and generations. It was kind of just, you know, that struggle, I think, in a big way, whereas my parents made that choice. So for me, that's my dad's legacy, right, where he and my mum have made that conscious effort to break that cycle and that pattern. So I want to honour that as I move forward in my journey. And I just have so much respect for them, man. Like, I would be around them all the time if I could, even though we drive each other nuts and, you know, we're a typical family. I don't want to say it's perfect, but it's, it's respect. I really admire what they've been able to achieve in their life, and I want to honour it and continue to develop what they've started.
And it's a tip of the cap to your parents and your grandparents to create good children like yourself and your brother, who have the mindset, the grounding, mm-hmm. and the environment that they created for you initially. I'd say that your parents would be, if I sat them here right now, if I asked them, you know, what do you think of Emma and what she's been able to achieve, and what do you think of Adrian and what he's been able to achieve, and do you sit here as proud parents, I think they'd unequivocally say 100% yes. They'd be super proud of you both.
No, I think
you both turned out to be fabulously good kids.
It's been a lot of hard work to get us there, though.
Always is. Hey, there always is that uphill battle with children is a natural part of the progress.
I think it's
process, I should say.
The biggest thing's, like, just genuine love, I think, and respect. And, like, you know, when you say I'm courageous, for example, I can be courageous because I've got that support and that love behind me. Like, I think kids that are brought up in that environment, it puts you so far ahead of the pack to have that unconditional, that love. And I mean that because sometimes, of course, parents love their kids, right? But sometimes they don't know how to show it or articulate it or be present in it. And we put emphasis on the wrong kind of things, you know, like it's about, for example, my dad could just, like, have worked really, really hard and done all of that and shown his love through what he's doing, but not express it to us or show us. And I might not know then, you know, I might see it differently. But my parents were always really big on, like, showing us that love and making us feel safe and secure. And I always knew that no matter what, I'd have their support and their backing. And I think that's where it's very easy to be courageous when you've got that support network behind you. And I think if you don't have it, you've got to create it for yourself. Like, you've got to create that network of great people around you who do have your back, who do support you, you know.
Through a professional network or friends or.
Exactly.
Mentors or whatever.
Like, find your people. Yeah.
No, it's a great, you've got a great mindset, great outlook on life, and your success is no surprise, to be perfectly honest. I mean, just looking, like I said, looking back at what you've done and the short amount of time, and it's essentially really in the last 5 years, like you say, where things have really changed, where your mind went from here to here. I think that's almost like a mooring line for you.
Yeah.
Where it's really, you know, when you're 25, 26, you've sort of just.
I think it was when,
gone for broke.
I sort of realised that I wasn't here to play games anymore. It was like, it's time to, you know, get serious. And, you know, like I said earlier, you know, Nick was working in commercial construction. It was, like, super long hours. It was really taxing on our family. Right before he left, he was stationed out in, like, Shepparton and, you know, working away from home, like living away from home. And it was really rough. You know, I was trying to grow this business and, yeah, it was hard. And I think that was like the real turning point for me was I sort of light bulb moment switched on, like I can be this catalyst in our family for living this life that we want to live, not out of necessity, but out of curation and creating what we want. And it had to come from me because it couldn't come from him because he was on this amazing trajectory of his own and like hyper successful. And I mean, you know, Nick is amazing, you know, the way he tackles things so meticulously and he's so thorough and has this way with words and, you know, he's great. So he was going to succeed in his industry, but like you were saying before, what's the trade-off? So he would have succeeded, but the trade-off would have been not spending any time with our family, missing out on Andre growing up. You know, that's his kind of story, right? Yeah. So I knew that I had to make the choice if I wanted to see my husband more and for him to spend time and be part of the family day to day and not be in that industry that is all consuming, you know, in a commercial sense, right? I needed to be the catalyst. So I had to bring it back in.
And that's where I say the courage comes from. See, it takes courage to make a decision like that.
Yeah.
And bravery, if you want to call it that as well. So you've got to, and probably I think the thing with you, it starts from a point of view where you have a vision for everything.
Yeah.
Right? You've got a vision with how you want it to look and where you want it to go.
Yep.
And without that vision, nothing can happen.
True.
And that starts and stops with you.
True. But it's also, I know a lot of people who have the vision and don't execute.
It's a fair point too.
You know, so you've got to actually follow through. And I think, like, to be fair, it's that neurodivergent brain, like it's that ADHD that for me, when I'm keen on something, like I'm all in and so hyper-focused and like that's everything that I'm able to execute it. You know what I mean?
When you're able to separate that focus into that one-dimensional mind, it's you read books now and I read a lot and many books are out at the moment about that concept of focus and hyper-focus and having a one-track mind. And it's really going back to what you're saying. If what you focus on, you attract.
Yep.
Typically.
Yep.
If your mind's in a number of different places and you're trying to multitask and you're trying to be something to everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah, something.
And it's knowing.
You're nothing to.
I think as like, for me, the owner of the business and, you know, creative direction and all of that, like I'll have that idea and I'll be hyper-focused to get it to a certain point. Once it's that point though, you need to know what your limitations are and how far you can get it and then handball it.
And who can help you get it to the next. Yeah.
And finding that right person to then, you know, Nick often says that like he's the person that comes behind me with the dustpan, the broom, you know, like pushing behind me, cleaning up the mess. And that's him, like I'll kind of really hyper-focus, get it to a point and then I need somebody to help me deliver that.
Execute it.
And continue it on because then I lose interest because it's that scattered brain.
So you better then in the visionary and planning stage versus the execution, would you say?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like I'll execute it to a certain point where it's like the foundations are all there, but then I need somebody to take it on from that point because then I lose all interest. Because
you're more the dreamer.
I'm already on to the
dreamer,
next.
The creative, the ideas person.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Got it.
Yeah, definitely.
Got it.
My probably biggest challenge is reining in all my ideas and like looking, you know, not taking too much on because I'll take a billion
and
things
one at
on.
A time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. That order, exactly. Order of simplicity we've referred to a few times.
Exactly. Yeah.
We're going to wind this down now. It's been nearly 3 hours, believe it or not.
Oh my God.
This has been really good to unravel the life of Emma. I'm just going to ask you a couple of quick things just before we wind it down. But how would you describe Dalesford?
Oh, that's just like home to me. It's weird because I don't live there.
what do you love about it so much?
I don't know. For me, when I'm there, it's just like this – I've got this like spiritual calmness and connection to that place. I don't know what it is. I can't really explain it. But it's I think it's nature and it's being, you know, the slowness of it, I think I'm really drawn to. Yeah.
And the New South Wales hinterland, what comes to mind when you think of that?
Oh, it's a similar thing. So, we have spent a lot of time in Byron and, you know, the surrounding areas and, you know, Bangalore is like probably my favourite place in Australia. I love it. If you've ever got the opportunity to go out there, just a beautiful, quiet town. But, yeah, again, like they've got similarities. It's the calmness and the stillness.
Just like do you – Could you see yourself living in a? You obviously like spending time there, but could you ever see yourself living in, you know, regional Victoria or regional New South Wales or something like that?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, is it actually?
100%.
Yeah. All right, okay.
Yeah, I'd love to, yeah, one day. Okay. For me, like the end game is I want, you know, regional property with a bit of land and have my chooks and
live
go back
off the
to.
Land. Yeah, right.
Yeah, okay. Yep. Go back to that, you know, that like life and still do all these things that I'm creatively passionate about. It. But I want to be able to build a business that's sustainable enough without me day to day where I can do creative direction and, you know, live somewhere in that space. Yeah, a bit lovely. Okay.
I like it. Sounds good.
Put it out into the universe. Manifest.
That's good. Manifest it and put it out there. It's out there now. You've got to make it happen.
Exactly.
So you made everything else happen so far. So, and I hear cooking's a big strength of yours.
Yes. That
even with sort of very little ingredients, with a few ingredients, you can whip up a storm. And I sort of said to Nick, so would you then describe it? It's a bit corny, but I said, would you describe it as like the MacGyver of the cooking world? If you're just a sprinkling of items and she can make something really, really good. What's your specialty? If we walk into the Vasi house, Camilleri house, Vasilievich house, what's cooking and what's your specialty?
I think
what do you nail?
Oh, everyone who knows me will say it's my potatoes, like our roast potatoes. That's probably the main
thing. You grow yourself or no?
No, but my nunnal does.
Okay.
Yeah, so he's got his potatoes and we reap the benefits of his it's hard work.
How big's a harvest normally?
Oh, I wouldn't even be able to tell you. I'm not sure. Yeah. Okay. I'd love to learn more about it. There's more goals that you bring out. Okay. But food-wise, I think it's just my love language and it's, you know, a creative way that I can express gratitude, really.
Yeah, to those you love.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, good. I also hear that Andre plays the piano.
Oh, he's just started, yeah.
And I hear that you may or may not be having lessons with him.
Yes.
How's that going?
It's good. I learned guitar early on in my life. So I was like 6 years old and, you know, had a guitar in the hand. And my poor mother endured many a lesson with me. But as I got older, I stopped playing, you know, guitar as much. Having the jam sessions with Nick, so he plays as well.
Yeah, he told me he plays. I was like,
But yeah, Andre's shown like a real like passion and interest in learning piano. And it's funny, I feel like once you can read music, it's transferable.
Yeah.
And I think it's just really big. And I've been watching a series on, I think it's Netflix, I can't remember, one of the streaming platforms of Chris Hemsworth's Limitless. I don't know if you've heard of it, but he's basically going on this journey of pushing himself, you know, through different things. And one of the episodes was about like neural pathways and keeping
the brain
active and working and trying to, I suppose, navigate dementia and Alzheimer's and things like that and for him. But I was really, inspired by it and I thought, what's something I can do to challenge myself and push my, you know, my brain out of its comfort zone a little bit? So I'm trying to, always trying to learn new things, new skills.
It's good stuff. And something I think I've heard you're pretty good at as well is singing.
Oh, God, he's lying.
Is he?
Yes. I'm not good at all.
Do you enjoy singing?
Oh,
another creative outlet?
Yeah. I think when we're having like a bit of a jamming sesh, like it's just fun.
Okay.
Like I wouldn't say I'm any good, but it's fun. Yeah.
Well, he was very
he's got rose colored glasses.
Well,
that
he said you're pretty he said you're pretty good, so.
Jeez.
And lastly, is there any truth to if you want to call it a rumor, that some of the pieces of art that you have hanging in some of the homes that you style are done by yourself.
Yes, that's true.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, yep. So
I did not know that.
I think it's, again, anything that you can do to like kind of steal your mind is really beneficial. And I'm just fortunate that I can do that and it, you know, happens to be helpful for my business as well.
How long have you been painting for?
My whole life, forever.
So again, another creative outlet.
Yeah. Yep. First, first painting I ever did, was so bad. But my dad still put it up in his he put it in the garage, like where the little toilet is, like above it. It's this like hideous armchair that I painted for him, and he kept it, and it's very sweet. But yeah, it's, I think anyone can do anything if you give it a crack and you're willing to learn and practice.
Push the limits, yeah.
Yeah, just, you know, don't give up on stuff. Like anyone can really do.
How often would you do something like painting, for example? Do it regularly or just occasionally?
Yeah, pretty occasionally, you know, now. But I'm always like once a week I'll pick up a pencil and draw, you know. Yeah. So it just, it's always something creative.
Yeah.
As in, you know, for work I'll be drawing every day. But I mean like creatively and personally, yeah. Probably once a week, you know, I'll get the sketchbook out. Like we were just, you know, away over the weekend and I had the little sketchbook out. And
cool.
Yeah, it's just a way to kind of still your mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, works well.
Well, it keeps like we said, all the neurons firing in the brain and, you know, talking about things like dementia and whatever else. And I think once people stop in their older – this is just my take on it. I've got no scientific proof or anything, but just my thoughts on things are, and I've sort of seen it with family members and friends and whatnot. Once people stop working, once people stop striving towards something, whatever it may be it a professional pursuit, a personal pursuit, like you said, a creative pursuit, something that you're just challenging your brain with different tasks, something,
yes.
And particularly if it's something new that you're learning.
Yeah.
A bit like the Hemsworth concept.
Exactly.
It does fantastic things for our brain because it keeps it firing all seasons. And I think once the brain slows down, I think that's when some of these things potentially may creep in. But I'm happy to be challenged on that because I don't know from a facts perspective with
sure.
scientific research by any means. But that's kind of my take on things. And you sort of see people slow down around you that are a bit older and when they stop working or when they stop doing things. And some people you hear, no, I'm never going to retire. And some people that are working, yeah, my mum only retired recently in her 70, basically 75th year.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. Like she probably wouldn't have ever thought that, but it kept her sharp and she loved the firing of the social element of work and keeping sharp. And now she walks a lot. She's got other things that keep her. She doesn't just sit around the house and not do much.
So keeping active, isn't it?
It's really, really important.
Yeah.
So I'm glad she's like that. So, but yeah, Emma, if there's anything else, is there anything else you sort of maybe wanted to leave us with or anything else that we don't know about you? Any other tidbits of things that I didn't find out about you?
No, I feel like,
I think I've uncovered them all.
Yeah, everything today. We've gone quite deep within who I am, I think, and where we're going.
I suppose probably the only other question I have for you then is – speaking of where we're going, and I mean the business is structurally going through some changes at the moment, and we sort of just discussed a little bit earlier about the trajectory of the business, and you talked about there's the potential of splitting the business up. So talk to us about that. It's a bit of an exclusive here, and Masters of the Game.
Exclusive, heard it here first. We this year will be relaunching our design part of the business under Varsi. So taking that, you know, our last name, it's my little baby, I guess the design arm of the business. So we're rebranding design and our like kind of lifestyle element of what we're doing. There's some really cool, exciting things happening with our showroom launch and the shop and our selections gallery and just really, yeah, taking – I suppose that more holistic approach under that brand, and then Elevate will continue to operate our property styling and maintenance arms of the business. So it'll kind of be real estate is Elevate, and everything else will be Varsi.
Awesome.
So,
and the space, the studio and warehouse space in Newport is looking unbelievable. It's nearly done.
Yeah. It's putting all the pressure on Nick.
Yeah. I saw it just before the new year, I think we're recording this in early January 2023. And I saw it maybe 2 weeks before Christmas, I think. It was looking fantastic. I can't wait to see that retail space, your office, and then the storage area at the back, the design area.
So cool.
Looks fantastic. So
thanks, man. No, I'm very excited to launch it, and keep your eyes and ears peeled. We'll be releasing some information on that soon, and we'll see you down at the launch party, I reckon.
Cool, I reckon. Yeah, I'll be there with bells on. But where can people find you on socials, Emma?
So at elevate_au is our Insta handle for Elevate. And Varsity hasn't been released yet, so I can't share that. But you can head to our Elevate website, so elevatestudio.com.au, and you'll find everything you need there.
Fantastic. And social media has been a real powerhouse of being able to build your business, hasn't it? With
huge.
You've got a huge following. You're really active on there all the time and using all the latest tools and latest design tools. And so it's great to see young businesses like yours, you know, really flourishing. And even the tool that you gave us to use when you've been designing our home.
Ah, the walkthrough.
Absolutely incredible to physically see the house come to life.
Mm.
So you guys are ahead of the game when it comes to tech and the availability that you have for your clients. So you're doing great things. Keep up the good work. Again, your story's a really deep and interesting one. You've done a lot in your young life already, in your 30 years.
Yes.
lots more ahead. Thanks so much for doing this today. I really, really appreciate it. It's been a thrill.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Emma Varsity.